Hi, everybody. I'm Mike Cuthbert. Welcome to Primetime Radio. We've become accustomed to political rhetoric that reflects the demands of the moment rather than the true character of the speaker. In at least one notable case, in at least one notable line, not only the character of the man, but the key to understanding his success as an administrator of government and politician are revealed. Abraham Lincoln said, "With malice toward none, with charity for all." Though it overgeneralizes the main attribute of Lincoln, the politician, it nevertheless is the key to understanding his success at maintaining a remarkably diverse yet successful cabinet through the most trying time of our republic's history, our Civil War. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin has spent the last decade in the daunting task of adding something new to Lincolnia. It's said his only rival for biographical studies in terms of number of books written about him is Christ. She has added to the Lincoln canon in Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, a monumental study not only of Lincoln, but of the nearly impenetrable briar patch of interests and ambitions that went into his cabinet. Indeed, after 754 pages, the overwhelming feeling one gets in completing her work is one of amazement that he was able to accomplish anything in the 5 years he served as our president. To tell us how he did it, we welcome Doris Kearns Goodwin back to our studios. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here with you again.
Lincoln seems to a lot of historians like Everest of the 4-minute mile. He's the standard by which everything is judged. What led you to spend a decade finding out new things to say about him?
You are right. I think he is the Moby Dick for historians.
Yeah.
But, you know, after spending 6 years with Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, such large figures who I enjoyed living with so much, there was nowhere else to go but Lincoln. I couldn't go back to Millard Fillmore or Franklin Pierce. And I wanted to learn about him, and I wanted to live with the Civil War, even though it meant I had to have a leap of faith at the beginning. Could I find some fresh angle? I had no idea what I would do at the start, but I just kept reading and thinking, and luckily a story emerged.
Where did you start?
At first, I started just reading the books on him. Then I started thinking I wanted to do Abe and Mary, as I had done Franklin and Eleanor, so I read about the two of them and their relationship. But then as I read about them, I realized that actually Lincoln was married more to the members of his cabinet in terms of the time he spent, the emotions that he shared, and going to the battlefront with them than he was to his wife. So I started reading about them. And then when I realized how many sources they had letters, they had diaries, all of those guys, unlike Lincoln, wrote private letters at night when they came home from the Civil War during the day, thousands of pages of letters to their family, kept voluminous diaries, and I began to feel their presence. And then when I realized, of course, that they were not simply members of his cabinet, but they had been his rivals previously, and that it was an unprecedented act for him to put them into his cabinet, then I knew probably, you know, a year or two into the research, I think I've got my story.
All I could think of was when you started this project, you found your thesis. And because Lincoln is so often studied, how much fear did you have that someone else would stumble on it before you finished?
You know, interesting thought. You know, I guess you do worry about that. But hopefully, knowing that it was going to take me such a long period of time, and I had gotten deeper and deeper into it, the hope was that it was going to, I knew it would take a long time, it would take somebody else a long time too. So theoretically, I might be able to still come before them.
Lincoln's political genius is evidenced most clearly by his managing of his cabinet, as your thesis proves, his team of rivals, Bates, Chase, Seward, and Stanton. What were the first evidences of his political acumen, though, before he reached Washington, before he could form a cabinet?
You know, I think what you see in his early life, for example, in 1855, when he lost his first Senate race, he really gave that victory to a fellow guy named Trumbull, who didn't deserve the victory, but he thought he'd be better for anti-slavery forces than he, Lincoln, thought the other guy, the pro-slavery guy, would be, even though Lincoln had been ahead of him in the votes. That magnanimity to do that and then not get angry with him and not turn away from him meant that eventually Trumbull becomes his supporter. So what you see leading up to the convention is that Lincoln rarely made enemies. He turned formal people who had hurt him into friends and allies. He kept a good spirit. He was positioned in the center of the party, not because he was moving there, but because he naturally had a kind of equable temperament to see both sides of every issue. I came away believing that his primary quality was empathy, that he really could feel the sides on both sides, what the people were arguing about, and then could speak, whether it was the North and the South or whether it was conservatives and radicals, he could understand them. And he evidenced that even before he won this surprising nomination.
Whenever I read history, especially as vibrant and as good as yours, I try to make it at least applicable to what we're going through today, to at least enlightening. And it seemed to me throughout your book that it proves that though Lincoln stands for anti-slavery, stands for pro-union, he most of all stands for pragmatism, which we have almost lost track of in the American politics of today. I don't know that we could understand a man like Lincoln who could form a cabinet like that, who could give away an election for pragmatic, in a way, long-term values.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think what's so moved me about Lincoln was, speaking of long-term, that early on he developed this burning desire to accomplish something great so his story could be told after he died. He was haunted by the idea that when we die, we turn to dust. So he adopted this almost Greek notion that if you accomplish something worthy, if you leave the world a better place, then your story will be told after you die. And that meant that he could lose certain battles along the way. He could give away this earlier election because it was in the larger interest of the country. He could lose another Senate race after that and not feel discouraged because he wasn't simply going after office or power. He was going after something much larger. I think there was a brilliant talent within this man that he knew he was destined for something. I'm not sure he would have talked that way, but that it allowed him to propel him through his depressions, through his failures. And it's a great story for so many other people when they see if somebody he's having a tough time. Lincoln had it so many times, but he kept going forward.
Our guest is Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her new study of Lincoln is called Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. Many analysts, particularly modern ones, have gone into great detail proving to themselves, if not to their readers, that Lincoln suffered from bipolar depression or clinical depression, whatever. You make an interesting point that as you study him, it's not so much depression, but a consistent melancholy.
Yes, I think there's a difference. I think he was born with a melancholy temperament. Studies have shown that you are either born with a melancholy temperament or an optimistic temperament. Events can change that either one way or the other. But what's extraordinary about himself was that he understood his sad moods and he figured out ways to get out of them. Humor was one. I had no idea how absorbingly funny he was and how remarkably able he was to take his sad spirits and suddenly start telling a story and his eyes would sparkle and suddenly he'd be feeling fine again. If he needed to get away from work in the White House, he was able to go to the theater 100 times to be able to replenish his energies. There's no evidence that ever time during the White House years he was dysfunctional or in a depression. He had one serious depression when he was younger, but he got himself out of that in part by saying, I might feel like I want to die now, but I haven't done anything to be remembered by. So that same lodestar carried him through.
As long as we're at that point, let's talk about Lincoln's spiritual nature, because as you point out, he had no belief at all in the afterlife, which would theoretically at least be the underpinning of a normal or common religious Christian faith. What was the nature of his faith?
Well, it is true. When he was a younger man, he wished he could believe in an afterlife, but he just wasn't sure it was there. And that put him at odds with most people in the country at that time because there were so many losses, so many deaths, that people had even more of a need when a little child would die. While the child is dying, they would often talk about, don't worry, and the child could say, I'm going to meet my siblings in heaven, I'm going to see my God. And it wasn't that Lincoln was defiant against it, he just wasn't sure he could believe in it. He believed in God, but instead then he adopted this idea that you could live on in the memory of others. And I think what happened is, as he got into the presidency, and as this war took a terrible toll, and he had to deal with the losses, 600,000 lives lost would be like 5 million lives today, he developed a deeper and deeper understanding of God and God's role in the world and God's role in this conflict.
You mentioned his humor. To me, one of the most fascinating parts of the book is you follow it as a sort of a sub-theme long enough to prove that those who initially denigrated Lincoln for his jocularity, if you will, eventually came to understand, almost all of them came to understand how important it was and how he used humor to diffuse situations or at least to explain in a more acceptable and understanding way some pretty thorny problems that were going on.
Oh, absolutely. You know, he'd start cabinet meetings where they were going to make some terribly hard decisions with some funny story. And at first, some of the stiffer cabinet members said, what is he doing, wasting our time? But most importantly, it just made human himself and the problems they were dealing with. There's a moment, for example, when somebody comes to him and says, you've just won the Republican nomination in 1864 for a second term. The only thing that'll prevent you from getting the full election is if Grant takes Richmond, and then Grant will get the Democratic nomination and probably win. So Lincoln looks at him and he smiles. He said, well, I just feel like the doctors told me that I have a fatal disease. But if so, that's the disease I would like to die from. Let's take Richmond. I mean, to be able to just, and there are times when somebody's saying something insulting. There was time when some job seeker, there's a wonderful story, a job seeker came in, and the person who had the job he wanted had just died, and he was still in the funeral home, the body of this person. So he comes into Lincoln, he said, you've got to let me take his place. You've got to let me take his place immediately. And Lincoln smiles, and he said, well, I'll see what I can do, but I'll have to check with the funeral director first. You know, I mean, it's just so that then he gets rid of the job seeker that way.
There's a tendency to overstress Lincoln's commonness, I think, and your book does it only by comparison. When you rack up the years of study, the money, and the background of Seward and Chase, and even Bates, the ultimate domestic who just...
who had 17 children.
Yeah, he didn't want to be there. He was the only one who was self-educated. He was the only one that didn't have wealth and experience. What gave him the edge?
Well, you know, I think what happened, it's so interesting. The way he educated himself was through a depth of reading rather than wide reading. These other guys had gone to college. They understood philosophy. They understood history. Lincoln spent his time as a child and then as a young adult reading Shakespeare, reading poetry, reading Aesop's fables, reading the Bible. And somehow, because it was all learned by himself, I think it became part of him. You know, there's something so emotional about the story of this young kid somehow searching the countryside for books. And books allowed him to transcend his surroundings. In that frontier world that he grew up in, books were looked at as lazy and indolent. He was supposed to be working on the farm, so he had to sneak away to do it. But Emily Dickinson once said, there's no frigate like a book to take one lands away. And they allowed him to go to England with Shakespeare's kings, to Spain and Portugal with Byron, places he would never go. It just shows the power, I think, of literature when it truly gets absorbed in somebody. And no one could write like him because he absorbed the cadences of this wonderful. It makes you think maybe we should read fewer books, but better books.
Is there evidence that he studied until he memorized, or he was a pretty absorbing reader from the start?
I think he was an absorbing reader from the start, but he clearly used the memory. I mean, much later, even in the Civil War, he'd be reciting whole passages from Shakespeare's play. So he must have learned them as a child or as a young adult, and then they never left him. But at some point, he had to actually memorize them. I mean, I don't know that he was one of those characters that you read it one time and it goes into your head. It mattered to him. So something that mattered to him stayed in him, and then he used it the rest of his life.
There was one other significant difference between Lincoln and his team of rivals, and that is Seward had Weed and the others had acolytes and staff managers. Pretty much, Lincoln tended to run everything by himself. True grassroots, I suppose. With what accruing advantages to him?
No question, great advantages, because I think what happened, for example, months before the 1860 election, Weed, as Seward's manager, thought it would be good for Seward to get out of the country so that he couldn't make any mistakes.
Duh.
Because he had been saying bad things that somehow rebounded against him. So he goes to Europe for 8 months, and he's feted by kings and queens. They think they're seeing the next president. Meanwhile, Lincoln is scheduling himself in one city after another to give speeches. He's writing letters to people. He's figuring out what's going on. He's figuring out that it's important to have the convention in Chicago. That was a critical thing. They were going to have it in some place or other, and all the committee members get together. Seward wants it in New York. Bates wants it in Missouri, and Ohio is where Chase wants it. And then they say, well, we don't really have a real candidate in Illinois. How about Chicago? And Lincoln engineered that in some ways. And of course, having it there was a great advantage because he could pack the hall with his friends. But he was his own campaign manager, which meant that he had a feeling for where the country was. He would talk to people. He was curious. He didn't let them decide anything. He was everything.
We should say, too, in all full disclosure, that Lincoln not only finagled the convention in Illinois, but immediately after it was announced, he also finagled a discount rate for people from Illinois to get on the train and go to Chicago.
Exactly so. No, I mean, he's not passive by any means. This is a very active manager of his own life and fortune. But it means that he had a greater control of the process than these other guys did who let other people do it for him.
Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest. Her incredible book is Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. You found at least one source who said that with a happier marriage, Lincoln might have stayed at home in Springfield. What are the sources for that judgment, and how accurate is that in your estimation?
Yeah, I think the people who said that, and there were several of Lincoln and Mary's friends that believed that, didn't really think it was a good marriage between Mary and Abe. And maybe it was a troubled marriage, but I just don't think that's right anyway. I think even if he'd had a happy marriage, his ambition was so deep to educate himself. For example, when he was on the legal circuit, all of his friends would go home on the weekends when they traveled around the state for 2 months in the spring and the fall, and he would stay away, and people thought that meant he didn't want to be with Mary. Maybe so, but I think also he had to educate himself. He was learning geometry at night. He was mastering the principles of grammar. And I think there's no way that he liked Bates. I mean, it is true that Bates, because he had his wife that he adored, didn't want to be away from. In the end, he wasn't away from her very much because of the 17 children being born. But he did diminish his ambitions because of his family. I think Lincoln's were too towering that no marriage, however happy, would have really made him happy without this larger goal being realized.
We've talked about Lincoln and his cabinet. We should mention that there are, of course, extended passages about Mary Todd Lincoln. And I wondered if you'd found anything new about their relationship that perhaps had either not struck you before or simple evidence of the nature of their relationship that we haven't understood before.
Well, you know, I think what surprised me, and I was glad to see it, there's been such negative commentary on her. So number one, I was glad to get the image of her when she was a young girl and could see why he had fallen for her. She's the belle of Springfield. She's a great conversationalist. She loves poetry and politics, and Henry Clay is her friend, who is Lincoln's idol. And I love the story that she told, that the first time he came to her and he saw her sitting there entertaining everyone, he said to her, "Mary, I want to dance with you in the worst way." And then she later laughingly said, "He certainly did." He was rather awkward as a dancer. But even though they lost their child in the midst of the Civil War, and in many ways she was never the same after that. They had had four boys, one who had died before the Civil War, and then this 10-year-old Willie died during the Civil War. She's left with her older son at Harvard and a younger son who nearly died at the same time. She was never able to recover from the depression. But what I did find that I hadn't fully absorbed before was that after she began to come out of it somewhat, she visited hospitals on a regular basis, and she was quite wonderful with the wounded soldiers, not at all taken aback by the terrible smells and the sights, arms and legs gathered up in barrels outside, and gave a lot of comfort and solace, but she didn't want publicity for it. So people at the time who didn't think that highly of Mary as First Lady, I wish they had known that. I think it might have made an easier path for her.
Mary Todd Lincoln was not, by the time of the Civil War, the most glamorous woman in Washington. That honor goes with multiple points in her favor to Kate Chase. On the other hand, Kate Chase seems to be an ideal subject for either a fictional biography or a film. She was a conniving, you know what I mean.
Yeah. It's an astonishing story. I mean, what happens is her father, Salmon Chase, is married three times. His first wife dies in childbirth at 22, his second wife at 25, his third in the early 30s. So he's left with this daughter, Kate. He sends her to a boarding school in New York to make sure she gets educated so she can be his first lady, his surrogate wife. She comes out a great conversationalist, absolutely fascinated by politics and manipulative with everybody around her to make her father the president. But sadly for her, she has all these men who love her. They considered her really the most beautiful, fascinating woman of her age.
But, so the princess died.
Yes, she absolutely was.
Thin,
and you know, a long willowy neck at a time when women were not thin. Yeah. So she looked even more unusual. But what happens is that she marries a very wealthy older man, Sprague, mainly, I think, for his money so that she can further her father's ambitions. And here's this girl who had everything, but it turned out so badly. It was an abusive relationship. He was an alcoholic. She ends up having children, one of whom commits suicide, and she ends up dying in poverty. So she paid a terrible price for this fascination with politics and her father, wanting to be the First Lady.
Because the title of your book is Team of Rivals, and because Salmon Chase was one of those rivals, what was the nature of the rivalry between the elegant, beautiful, manipulative Kate Chase and Mary Todd Lincoln, the First Lady?
Oh, well, Mary Todd was so jealous of the fact that when Kate would walk into a room, all eyes turned toward her. If there were a reception at the White House, people would write about what Kate was wearing rather than Mary, who had spent many months figuring out what to wear. And actually, when Kate did get married in 1863 and her wedding was the social event of the decade, Mary refused to go. And there was some bad words between Kate and Mary. I mean, it was as if she saw a rival for the social light of Washington.
We already mentioned briefly the times that Lincoln operated on faith that good works would be returned. And I stress again, because you make such an interesting point of it, the reason he did this is because he believed this was it. There was going to be no reward except what you got here. He ceded the Senate election to Trumbull, and then he treated Democrats. We'll get into a little bit of the description of the complex and explosive, I think that's the best word, political situation in the early 1860s. But particularly the treatment of the Blair family of nearby Maryland, many of whom are still around, I think, and the whole record of forming his cabinet alliances from the best rather than from party loyalists or cronies. What gave him the sense that he could do this when everyone told him it wouldn't work?
I think somehow Lincoln understood that given the variety of opinion that made up this new Republican Party, because many of the people who were in this fledgling party had been Whigs, others had been Democrats, some were radical, some were conservative, that the only chance he'd have to keep that coalition together in the North, spread through all those states in the North, was if he could get to know the people that represented those ideas on a personal basis. And even though he would disagree oftentimes with the members of the Blair family, far more conservative eventually than he was, they respected him. And at one point, he needed Blair's resignation as his postmaster general. And Blair was sad to have it happen, but he gave it to him willingly and never lost respect for Lincoln. And he needed it because the radicals were upset with Chase, who had resigned, so he needed to balance it somehow. He had this automatic balancing. If I do this for the radicals, I got to do this for the conservatives. But it was done through the people that he knew. And because he was so good with these people, so sensitive, so kind, they didn't take it out on him personally. They understood what he was doing.
The fundamental issue that they seemed split about was the issue of the role of slavery in the Civil War. We think now, a lot of us, that that was the issue, but it clearly was not. As we split up these parties, so our listeners can have some idea of who's coming from where, what were the radicals and the conservatives, the Democrats and the black Republicans versus the Republicans, the war Democrats versus the other? What were their stands on the issue, and what was Lincoln's eventually?
Well, clearly the radical Republicans, to start there, believed that the purpose of the war should be to emancipate the slaves, and that that was the primary reason why we were going to war. And then there were, within that same Republican Party, people who believed that saving the Union was the primary purpose of going to war, and that as long as we could get the Southern states back into the Union, get them out of secession, even if slavery remained in the South, then the purpose would have been solved. So that's a split on that end. Then in the Democratic Party, you've got what are called War Democrats and Peace Democrats. The War Democrats, again, believed in the saving of the Union, and even though they were not happy with the Republicans having won the power, they were for the Union. It's a time like a war happens, so people come on both sides and they come together. But there were these Peace Democrats who really believed that the war should come to an earlier end. They definitely did not want slavery ended. They tended to have commercial ties with people from the South. A lot of Peace Democrats came from cities like New York City, who were merchants and well-to-do people. And they were also Irish Catholics and the immigrants who had come, who were part of the whole ward boss system and didn't have much empathy either for ending slavery. And the Peace Democrats, who later became called the Copperheads, really became a very difficult strand for him to deal with because they were openly going against the war. They would do certain things to hurt the war effort, and they had to be isolated. And he managed to do that slowly but surely.
Was it not the Copperheads who were primarily responsible for the draft riots in New York?
Absolutely. I mean, they figured that this was a time when they could get at Lincoln and get at the country and get at the morale. And those draft riots were devastating because it looked like the country was not supporting the war effort. And however, what Lincoln did, which was so smart, he eventually went right out again and called for even more soldiers to come in rather than being, you know, stymied by it. He just called for more, gave some great speeches, and was able to keep that morale going.
There has been much discussion about Lincoln's, not racism, but certainly his attitudes on race and the slavery question. I thought one of the most interesting things you quote him as saying as a campaign dictum is, a universal feeling, whether well or ill-founded, cannot be safely disregarded. He was dealing with a society that half believed in slavery, half didn't, and the other half, as they say, wasn't sure. How did he treat that challenge politically, and how did he change?
Well, the interesting thing is, when he said a universal feeling cannot be ignored, he was recognizing at that time that we were living in a society in the 1850s and early 1860s where even if people were against slavery, the overwhelming majority were not for equality between blacks and whites. And sometimes people take Lincoln out of context and say that he was a racist for that judgment. He was simply saying, I'm not sure that in our country blacks will ever achieve inequality. And that's why he talked about maybe they would rather go back to the Africa from which they came and be treated on full equal level. And people look at that and it sounds so terrible. But the saddest thing is much larger than that. The country itself was feeling that way. And what happened is it took 100 or more years even to get voting rights for blacks. When we think about how long it took until the 1960s, showing how long we had to go to begin to erase the prejudice that was built into our system. But the most interesting thing is Frederick Douglass, his friend, finally came to understand that he was a great politician. He understood where the country was. He had to move slowly because the country was moving, but he moved them gradually toward emancipation, toward black soldiers, and eventually it would have been toward black voting.
There's lots more to come when we continue our conversation with Doris Kearns Goodwin, including the horrible events of the spring 1865 at Ford's Theater and around Washington. Thank you.